Thanks everybody for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. It's always good to see people interested in walking some commit literature when it's this nice outside. I want to thank you for reading Frank O'Hara. I'm not intimidated. next group, you could maybe go with James Comey's new novel. Just to, you know,
set the bar a little. Just
right. Thanks everybody. It's a piece called Cleanliness. I come home to the smell of meat, not the subtle wafting of sirloin tips or pounded cutlets sauteing as a prelude to being served with thick sticks of asparagus, but the concentrated odor of raw meat, pungent, overpowering, as if our front door led to the killing room of an abattoir. Briefcase still in hand, overcoat across my shoulders like a cape. I follow the broken trail of styrofoam packaging and plastic wrap through our cramped shotgun apartment to the bathroom. Chops and shanks, roasts and ribs oxidize in a brown heap next to the space heater. My boyfriend, a firefighter who's recovering from a bad time, punches in our cramped tub, drizzling the remains of one of the packages through his thinning hair. And I ask, what has happened? He smiles beatifically up from the tub. I spent $170 at the butcher shop. He is nude. His pubic hair is soaked flat against his body. A pool of thin red fluid has formed beneath him and rises to the top of his pale feet. Although wildly inappropriate, this spectacle reminds me of the time my sister Carol got a period in the pool. I am being washed in the blood of the lamb, he tells me finally. My boyfriend is relaxed. Unconcerned with my reaction, he keeps on wringing what I believe to be a shoulder chop across his hairless chest a little below the nipples. That's a metaphor, I tell him. That means if you go to church, God will forgive your sins. Are you so sure of that? And although in 15 minutes, I will call the psychiatrist and Lewis will spend several days under observation before returning home with a prescription for a powerful antipsychotic. For this one luminous moment, the way he looks up at me from his pool of watery redness, the relief etched across his face as with numinous acid, this man I love, he makes me wonder. I think most people like to eat, so this is called the food speaker. In Italy, long ago, nestled far up in the mountains where the thin air chilled and the pure sun shone, there was a village that for generations had dispersed with language in favor of food as the agreed upon method of communication. Crisp pastries plumped with seek no more apples smoothed the way in courtship. Demitasses of steaming espresso suggested the need to be vigilant. Tureens of cold parsnip soup seasoned with bitter herbs alerted a man to his wife's budding anger. Neither Bibles nor portraits, but recipes were passed down through families. What better way, the villagers thought, to tell a girl her great-grandmother had been hot-tempered and adventurous than sending her a stew so spiced with cayenne and paprika, it singed the tongue just to taste it, or to let children know that Uncle Gio came from Naples, then placing before them heaps of fusilli doused with a red sauce stewed from dozens of the season's finest heirloom tomatoes and bursting with fresh basil. Every year at Midwinter's Eve, when the days were short and friendships brittle, the village pulled itself together for a tremendous feast. Ham cured with honey and platters of trout and heaps of succulent greens graced a table the length of a horse farm. And all the villagers sat down together to break bread and mend fences. The meaning of this meal for the villagers was, we are a good people of hardy stock, living close to the earth. Our hearts know the bitter and the sweet, and like meat cured in the smokehouse, we will last. Year after year, the festival meal became more and more elaborate. It started with men chanting the high, snowy passes to trek to the railway station at Abruzzi to bring back fresh lamb. Then, boys borrowed bicycles and later cars to retrieve seasonal fruit from the sun coast in Spain. As this augmentation increased, the meaning of the festival evolved to signify we are a prosperous village, industrious, and willing to exert every effort to get our due. By the time the fresh shrimp and oysters were being trucked in from the islands far to the south, the festival had come to mean as the best and most eloquent village in all of Italy. La Elementare gli Autoparlanti, or the food speakers. We are entitled to know every dish on the green earth and every delicacy plucked from the deep blue sea. Nearly all of the people in the village were proud of its growing fluency, and myriad flutes of champagne were hoisted high in celebration. The first year, the lobsters packed in ice were flown in by helicopter. An old man rose to castigate his fellow villagers for forsaking their time-honored ways. His fork trembling, he fed everyone seated around the long table a small bite of each of the old dishes in turn, and flung each of the arrivist foods to the snowy ground. As he did this, all the villagers raised their bitter cups, lock in step, and placed them carefully back in their saucers without having drunk to show penitence. But as the meal ended, they brought the old man a small plate of almonds, sprinkled with a fine dusting of poison. In the old language of food, this meant, shut the hell up, you old fossil, you've talked enough. With no protest, the old man lodged himself quietly in a chair at the end of the long festival table, and sitting alone, ate the almonds, chewing meticulously, happy, at least for this last short day, to have put things right. You know, I used to be a technology executive, so this is really embarrassing on some level, but I didn't know how to, I messed up with the stopwatch. It's not actually running, it says like 2 seconds, and I think I tapped the button twice. So I have really no idea how we're doing on time, but I'll leave one. It's called Boyhood. When I was a young boy, growing up in a seal town, preoccupied with collapsing in on itself, I wanted to shoot my father with a .22 caliber rifle. He had given me the single shot bolt action rifle for my 10th birthday. And for many nights afterward, I fantasized about striding into his bedroom in the middle of the night and pushing the barrel flush against his chest as he slept and pulling the trigger. In these imaginings, I would always give some impassioned, self-justifying speech right before squeezing the trigger and seeing the muzzle flash and hearing the crack of the rimfire cartridge propelled down the blue barrel. My father, a former infantryman in the Marine Corps, would have to listen to these speeches because he would be too scared to move. In my pre-assassination screeds, I would trumpet my secret strength, extol my individuality, and rant about how I wasn't going to take any more of his beatings. Some mornings after nights like this, I would ride my father's secondhand car down to the unemployment office My father and his buddies, most of whom were also laid off from the town's steel mills or the bituminous mines, referred to these trips as going to town. Once, in the afternoon, as a boy growing up in the steel town, pretty far gone irrevocably to shit, I attempted to stab an uncle of mine to death with an 8-inch fish filleting knife. My uncle was a large, bushy, bearded man laid off of his job as a rail car welder. I walked in on him beating my grandmother with a leather belt. She had fallen to her knees in the eat-in kitchen of her frame house. She held her other hand above her head, elbow bent at an acute angle to ward off the blows. My uncle's voice filled the room like whiskey and ice cubes can fill a glass. My grandmother's breath was all gasps. Tears streamed from her eyes. She pleaded, "Stop, Eddie. Oh, please stop." Oblivious to anything but his own rage, my uncle raised the belt and brought it down again. I watched this happen once, then twice. The third time he brought the belt above his head, I picked up the fillet knife from a cutting board next to a brook trout on the sideboard near the door. I ran toward my uncle, cursing him, fillet knife held out in front of me like a sword. My uncle turned. With the back of his hand, he sent me sprawling. When my father came in from parking the car, he saw the condition my grandmother was in, put my uncle in a wrestling hold, later called the volunteer ambulance service. What I'm trying to say is this. Even though the biggest part of me feels like these things happened in another lifetime, happened almost to someone else, that's never going to be the important part. Day or night, I can be inside out with the need to twist this darkness into some trompe l'oeil kind of virtue, into something I can wear like grace. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.